morning, everyone. We'll start with our blessing as soon as I light our candle here. All right. Baruch atah Adonai Eloheinu melech haolam Asher bachar banu mikol ha'amim V'natan lanu et torato Baruch atah Adonai Notein ha'torah. Amen. Today we are on the final parsha of the book of Vayikra, the book of Leviticus, which is the parsha of Bechukotai. And it begins on page 709, page 709, Parsha Bechukotai. And I have a number of things to talk about today. The first actually I want to bring up is a little bit after the fact. Yesterday was a holiday, which some people may or may not have been aware of. Yesterday was the holiday called Pesach Sheni, which was the second Pesach. And that holiday is described and commanded in the Torah that came about from the second year when the Jewish people were in the desert and it was time for the Pesach offering. One of the stipulations for the Pesach offering is that somebody had to be in a state of ritual purity in order to offer the Pesach offering or to eat from it. And if someone had come into contact with a dead body and had not yet had a chance to go through the purification process, they were ineligible. So if someone is ineligible to do something, it's really not, there's no mark against them. Either you're eligible or you're not eligible. They didn't do anything wrong, because we know that attending to a dead body is a mitzvah. So it was, they were doing something good, but it still made them ineligible for the Pesach offering. So there's a group of people who go to Moshe at that time, in the second year in the desert, and they say, basically, why should we miss out? You know, we want to be able to do something too. And so Moshe says, stand here, let me go ask God what you should do. And comes back with an answer and says, okay, on the 14th of the month of Iyar, which was yesterday, the following month, then you come and you will offer a Pesach offering with matzah and maror, the same way the Jewish people did for the actual Pesach offering. There's no prohibition against having chametz, though, but the offering has to be done with matzah. So the people then celebrated a second Pesach. So the question is, was it really Pesach? And the answer is, of course it wasn't Pesach. Pesach is in Nisan. So what really was this? So this holiday is understood to be the holiday of, but I want to be part of it too. Holiday, and I want it holiday, which is an amazing idea that there's a holiday that's about I want it, and that is such a fundamental idea in Yiddishkeit and Jewishness, is you gotta want it, and wanting it was meritorious enough to create a holiday around it. So what people have the custom of doing today is having matzah on Pesach Sheni. I thought it was any time during the day. It was really supposed to be before noon. So I had mine at 7 o'clock last night, but it was before sunset. I thought I was doing good. But anyway, next year I'll have a third chance on my Pesach Sheni. But the other question is that the idea of Sheni, of a second time, is that the word second and Sheni in Hebrew also has to do with the idea of change. It has to do with change or repetition, a second time. That, like when we talk about mishaneh, means to change something. So when we talk about change in a second time, it also gives us the idea that we can change something the second time around, and the idea of second chances. And that the second chance, you can change what you did the first time around. And that kind of the great bumper sticker that says, God allows U-turns. It's like, it's not always the case that in the situation for the specific Pesach Sheni, it was that the people were involved with doing something good, attending to the needs of a dead body. That was good, and that's why they missed Pesach. But it really speaks to the idea also that there are times in our lives where we need to have can I just push reset? Can I reboot? Can I redo this? Can I start over? Can I have another chance? Whether it's with ourselves, giving ourselves permission to have another chance and not falling into a place of despair. Can I have a second chance? Or extending that to a friend or a family member or somebody you know who has, done something wrong. Can you give someone a second chance? And the truth is giving someone a second second chance sometimes is more powerful than the first chance because the person's so grateful that they got the second chance, that there is might be even more a deeper happiness there. So this idea of second chance also comes this whole week of Hod, which is the sphera that we're in the counting of the Omer. Today is Gevura Shebechod. Hod is about yielding, about letting go, and there's a certain amount of the idea that when we want a second chance, to give ourselves a second chance, to be given a second chance, means letting go. Letting go of what the person did, what I did. Sometimes we make a mistake and then we hold on to it with such, you know, well, this is what I did, this is what I did. It's like, let it go and start over. Well, I can't, but I did this. And we hang on to all of the drama around what we did so that we don't let go and just start over. Or we come to wrong conclusions about what the error might mean, and we start judging ourselves. I must be the biggest loser. Maybe I shouldn't be doing this. Maybe I can't do anything right. I mean, we can beat up on ourselves as well. So part of the hode of letting go and yielding to oneself as well is God does want us to succeed. God is not like, okay, you have one chance and 15 minutes and then it's over. It's like, let's try that again. I mean, God is certainly on plan, I don't know, double A something, YZ, with humanity, with all of us, that there's always second chances. So we see a very strong example of this on Lag BaOmer, which is with the death of Rabbi Akiva's students. So we know that Rabbi Akiva's students, 24,000, that's a lot of students, that's a lot of funerals to go to between Pesach and the 32nd day of the Omer, which will be on this Saturday, the 32nd days, and on the 33rd day, they stopped dying. So you know why they stopped dying? There was no one left. No one left. It wasn't like, oh, they stopped, and then there were a few who were left, and so that's why we can celebrate, oh, at least these remained. There was no one left. You think, well, what a bizarre celebration that is. The fire is, why is the fire over? Because the house is burned to the ground. And he's like, oh, hooray, the fire is over. It's like, well, that's because your house is completely gone now. So you went, that's kind of a strange celebration to have. But from the Rabbi Akiva perspective, he could have said, and I read this in Devar Torah Online, said that Rabbi Akiva could have said, you know, maybe I should go into computer programming instead of being a rabbi, because clearly that didn't work out so well. All my students died for their failure. But instead, what does he do? He goes out and he says, okay, I'll get some more students. And he goes out and gets 5 more students and starts all over again. It's a true case of a second chance and starting over again. So this entire week of Hod, and specifically culminating on Lag BaOmer, which is the convergence of Hod Shebehod. So Lag BaOmer is always on the week of Hod, and it's always the convergence of the quality of Hod that is in Hod. So it's the doubled to the second power, however you want to understand it, of yielding and letting the situation be what it is and saying, okay, now we start over again. So hopefully none of us deal with anything as devastating as that, such a clear sign where you can imagine what people might be saying. You know, we thought Rabbi Akiva was really something, but look what happened to his students. If you had a university where all the students failed or all were arrested or all went, something showed complete lack of accomplishment, you would say, I think that person needs to close their school or close their business. It's clearly a failure. So labeling something a failure, especially ourselves, is a non-starter when it comes to anything Jewish perspective. So we're always about second chances, starting over, doing it again, and this is what we're trying to focus on, and we'll celebrate on Lag BaOmer. So I was thinking of a nice kind of idea to have if you're present at a bonfire of any kind, and I think there are several organizations that are having Lag BaOmer celebrations, is the idea of fire is kind of putting into the fire, you know, like little pieces of paper that represent your failures of yourself or things, activities, projects, whatever it is, put it in the fire and let it go. So you could say, well, it's a little bit like burning chametz, you know, you like burn it and let it go. But there's something really interesting about fire, which is fire reveals energy that is embedded in whatever it is you're burning. So it's like, what things burn? Things that have energy in them. So that there is energy in failure that is meant to be harnessed. So if it goes into the fire, it's like we release the energy recycle it back, and start over again. And that's the power of fire. Maybe something that why we are intrigued with fire, that watching something burn is so interesting. It's not just the destruction of it, because you can destroy things in lots of different ways, but it's the release of the energy of what it turns into. And the kids, like in Israel, they're going around, and they have been collecting since Pesach, sticks and, you know, a leg from a chair or a table, all the stuff they are collecting, all the combustibles, all the things that appear to have. That's what's interesting. It's usually stuff that you would call trash. It's like, that's the stuff that you got rid of. It's like, ah, but the stuff you got rid of actually has energy in it. Because just because you think it's done now, it can be reformed. Because there's no such thing as the loss of energy. That's one of Einstein's principles or one of the thermodynamics or whatever. There, you can't get rid of energy. You can only reform it. So something that was trash is truly can be reconfigured into treasure. And the power of fire shows us that very graphically and visually, that we're able to see something change and literally transform before our eyes and have it be released to its energy for us to then take back and reuse. So that's one idea that we have, Patricia.
I mean, that's such a beautiful explanation, but where did the custom of bonfires
come from?
I mean, is it something in Torah or just...
It comes from because... The Lag BaOmer is the yahrzeit of Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, called the Rashbi. Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai was one of the five new students who was under Rabbi Akiva, and who was one of the greatest. And when before he died, he, it says he was like fire. It says the people whose names are Shimon, that you remember Shimon and Levi were the ones who went after the people, the city of Shechem, that raped Dinah. So Shimon and Levi have this fire in them. And it says, in fact, at the beginning of Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai's life, that he was very judgmental against people who were not completely every moment spending devoted to Torah study. If he saw someone out plowing their field, he would say, "Why aren't you studying Torah?" And he would look at them and they would burst into flames and like be destroyed. So he was a little too intense for this world. So God's like, "You go back to your cave." He's the one who spent all the years in the cave with his son. And when he came out again, he saw somebody, so the story says that he saw somebody, he got rehabilitated in that way, and he saw somebody walking with two myrtle leaves on a Friday afternoon. He's like, "What are you doing with myrtle leaves?" He said, "Oh, it's for the honor of Shabbos, the smell, it will be so beautiful." The previous Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai would have said, "There's no halacha to bring myrtle to your house, like what are you doing that for?" But he's like, "Oh, isn't that beautiful that someone who loved of Shabbos, who wanted to enhance their Shabbos with the fragrance of myrtle, and he blesses them." So it says Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, he goes from being called Rabbi Shimon to how we normally refer to him now, which is Bar Yochai, which means son of Yochai, who was his father. His father was a peaceful, people-loving person. Shimon was fire. Shimon Bar Yochai, so he's either called Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai or Bar Yochai. So it's either put together that quality of that fire with a love of people, or he's just called Bar Yochai. It says when he was about ready to die, which was on Lag BaOmer, that he was surrounded in the cave with flames, and his students couldn't see him. He was shielded by these flames. And when the fire went out, he had died, but there was a smile on his face. The smile of Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai. So fire has come to be associated with Lag BaOmer of the yahrzeit of Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai. And there's a whole long song that people sing about Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, his Torah, and his greatness. So he is one of the more frequently quoted rabbis in the Talmud, is the Rashbi, is what he's called, Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai. Susan, and then Naomi. So there is historical documentation that says that it was by the Romans, but the Talmud says that they died of plague. And specifically, they name it as what sounds like croup, that it was that they all died during that period of time.
How was that Rabbi Akiva's fault?
That they died by croup? Or anything is because when people die like that, there's a reason for that, that God doesn't, things don't happen for no reason. And especially those 24,000 students, they were our, they were our Torah. They were our foundation, and that was the transmittal of Judaism to the next generation. And there was some, there must have been something wrong with them, kind of like in the times in the land of Israel when there was a war. The only people who died were people who there was a flaw in them, because only the most righteous people went out to war. It was assumed that if you died in a commanded war in the land of Israel, that there was something. Now, we don't say that, God forbid, we don't say that, like if somebody in the IDF falls or something, we don't say, well, there must have been a flaw in them. But we say God is running the world and that there was a reason for them, and we accord it to a lack of respect. So a lack of respect, that's what we understand, is that students died from a lack of respect of one another, but it was at a level that was at the highest, highest level, that it wasn't as if they were in a drunken brawl in the yeshiva and not respecting each other, that it was at the highest level. So some of the descriptions used are that, for example, they wouldn't quote one another. If one of them had an insight, the other one would say it, an insight, but they would kind of claim it as their own and not quote the other person. Or they wouldn't share their insight, that there was some sort of not complete connection, because it talks about it wasn't just 24,000 students, it was 12,000 pairs of chavrusas. So there was something that was wrong, and the word chavrusa comes from the word chaver, which means friend, and chibur, which means connection. So there was something wrong in the connection, and for that was a fatal flaw. If you are the foundation, it's like if you were building a building, and there was something, if there was a crack in the foundation, you can't say, well, we'll just paint it, and then we'll build on top of it. You have to take it out. So it says, if there was something wrong in that foundation, it had to be taken out. And because connection between the students and that respect is the foundation of Torah, because we know, what does Rabbi Akiva say, is the klal gadol, the fundamental principle of the Torah is v'ahavta l'reacha kamocha, you shall love your neighbor as yourself. So that's what he was teaching. So even more so, if you have an academy that is founded on a particular principle, then everyone's going to be looking for sure at how that principle is being carried out. So no one said there was anything wrong with their Torah, that there was anything wrong with their studying. And in fact, the opposite. They were at such a lofty level, and the loftiness of level brings with it the responsibility of bringing that loftiness down into action. And so they were held more accountable, more so than the average person. Anybody else acting the way they did would have been considered a regularly fine, good, upstanding person. But for them, at that place, at that time, with their lofty level, to be missing even a minute amount of what they were supposed to be bringing down to earth in their personal practice was a fatal flaw. And so that's why they are eliminated. And Rabbi Akiva then starts over to rebuild the foundation, which is what he does. And the rabbis that are quoted in the Talmud are his five students. Basically, those are the fundamental rabbis who are quoted. Naomi.
One of the things I heard about Lag BaOmer with Rabbi Bar Yochai is that he did not want people to mourn on his yard site. He wanted a celebration. So. Because of the fire, that's why we have a bonfire to celebrate.
Celebrate, yes. And you are right. It's a celebration of his life. And that's why people go to where he is buried in Israel, which is Meron. And that's where there are, they bring boys for their upshirin, for their haircutting. Their first haircut is done on Lag BaOmer. And it's like Woodstock there. I mean, it is, I haven't been there, but, you know, first of all, the smoke from all the bonfires. You know, and then thousands of people converging, and then all these upshearing, all of these haircuttings, and people there, and it's music, and it doesn't feel like it feels almost more like what we would call a wake, where you're a celebration of the person's life. It's not like a shiva house at all. So on the yort side of a person is also the time, it says, where their neshama, and that's for all of us, on our yort sites or another loved one's yort site. The yort site time is a time when the person's neshama kind of reconnects to its place of burial and becomes more accessible. There are people who, you know, they go there to pray. They go there to pray for children, for marriage partners, for healing from sickness, all sorts of things. That's one of the graves is considered very beneficial to go to, and especially on Lag BaOmer. So it brings a lot of people. Roberta.
Where is Mount Meron?
Meron is near Tzfat.
Oh.
Yeah, so people go up there.
Is it
with him.
Were you studying in Sfat?
I'm sorry?
Was Rabbi Akiva in Sfat?
No, I don't believe so. But that's where Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai is buried. I'm not sure why he's buried there in Mount Meron. I'm not sure where they were. I don't believe that he was in Sfat. That could be wrong, but I'm not sure. He maybe traveled around. I'm not sure. So, good question. That would be a history geography question where I'm a... until I have my second chance and become that in my next incarnation, become really, really good at those things, but not yet. So this is the time of second chances that we talk about, and we learn from Rabbi Akiva, who we know was the most optimistic person ever. And so it's like that, you know, sadness and despair, there's no excuse for that. So like, we are an optimistic people, and whether as at a community, about the world, about everything, that's what we are all about, and we're all for second chances, Pesach Sheni. And so if you can have a Sheni, I'm sure you can have a Shlishi, third chance, fourth chance, fifth chance, all of the different chances that we need to have. Okay, so, this is the other thing that we're supposed to take the opportunity for on Lag BaOmer, in addition to the idea of kind of throwing our mistakes and errors into the fire and burning it up. And thank you very much. Is that it's considered an auspicious time to do teshuvah as well. Because it's not enough just to throw the mistake in the fire. There has to be a plan for how is this not going to happen again? What am I going to do differently? Whatever it is a part of our life, whether it's something in our life with a relationship or our physical lives or our emotional life, what are we going to do differently? We can't hope that just by releasing the energy and bringing it back to us, that unless it's channeled into new behavior or a new strategy, a new action, we'll probably end up with the same mistake one more time, and then next Lag BaOmer will be kind of throwing the same piece of paper right back in the fire. It's like, how did this boomerang back to me? So we don't want the boomerang effect. We want it to be able to be harnessed. So that's our opportunity on Lag BaOmer as well. It's a little hard to remember to do that because of the festive nature of the day. When there's music and dancing and partying going on, it's not a natural thing. Oh, yeah, teshuva. That's what I'm thinking about right now. I mean, that's easier on Yom Kippur when you're kind of like in the mood. That's Rosh Hashanah. This 10 days of teshuva. So that's easier then. Lag BaOmer is a little harder to get to, but it's coming from a place of love. So teshuva from a place of love is considered at a higher level than teshuva from a place of fear. So the feeling on Lag BaOmer is one of love and happiness, and that is really a place to motivate us. Some people are more motivated by fear, but the goal is to really try to get to be at a place where we're motivated by love and aspiration and inspiration rather than a fear of retribution and punishment. So that's what we're trying to get to on Lag BaOmer. So whatever your plans are, as it happens, it works out very well that it's on Sunday. So that makes it a time when it's easier for people to celebrate it rather than like on a Wednesday or sometime when it doesn't fit into people's plans quite so easily. So that's the opportunity for this coming Sunday. So it officially starts Saturday night, is after Shabbos is when Lag BaOmer begins. So hopefully everybody will enjoy that. So Lag BaOmer, the reason it's Lag is that it's the gematria of Lamed Gimel, which is 33, the 33rd day of the Omer. So Lamed is 30, Gimel is 3, it's the 33rd day of the Omer. So what's really interesting, and I learned this from a shiur from Rabbi Aryeh Carmel, is that our parsha for today, the parsha of Bechukotai, is the 33rd parsha of the Torah, and that it almost always tends to occur at the time of Lag BaOmer, or at least within the month of Iyar when we are counting the Omer. But the 33rd, so for this time, so that we're in the Parsha of Bechukotai, which is the 33rd Parsha of the Torah. And it's interesting, too, and we'll talk about the content of what's in here. So now let's take a look at page 709 and start reading verse 3, which is the beginning of Parsha Bechukotai. Valerie, can I call on you today to start that?
If you will follow my decrees and observe my commandments and perform them, then I will provide for you rains in their time, and the land will give its produce, and the tree of the field will give its fruit. Your threshing will last until the vintage, and the vintage will last until the sowing. You will eat your bread to satiety, and you will dwell securely in your land.
Okay, great. So as you can see in the margin here, that this is, the description is the miracles of blessing and curse. Okay, so this parsha has the blessings and the curses. Now, most people, when you hear the miracles of the blessings and the curses, what kind of strikes you as odd about that description?
Curses
are miraculous. It's like, well, that doesn't really seem like, okay, that kind of miracle I'm not so interested in. I'll take the miracle of the blessing. So we say it's a miracle for the Jewish people that the blessings and curses, which we're going to see, happen in the realm of the physical world, not the spiritual world. The blessings and the curses are in the realm of the physical world. Normally, we understand that the physical world is run by the laws of nature, which, of course, God also created, but that they are predictable, as opposed to the blessings and the curses, which are in the realm of the physical world and are not based on the natural occurrences, are considered they are the direct hand of God. And that's a very different idea, and that's what makes it miraculous, because it's going to come and go, not because the almanac says that the weather's going to be something this year, but because of the behavior of the Jewish people. So it's a completely different relationship, which is why it's called a blessing. So the section starts, and actually I want to just give a footnote. I'm sorry to go back to Lag BaOmer, but another thing that I just learned from Rebbetzin Mizrahi is that Lag BaOmer is always the same day as Purim. So that's another connection to its day, the same day of the week. So Purim was on a Sunday, and also Lag BaOmer is on Sunday. So it's always the same day of the week, and it's a further connection to the idea of it being a time of happiness, that it has the Adar quality to it, of a time of joy. And Purim was the time when the Jewish people did teshuva based on love rather than on fear. So it's the same, a similar idea. So I just wanted to back up because I saw my little note on that. All right, so back to our blessings here. Notice that they are not called rewards and punishments, that we're not talking about reward and punishment. There is no reward in this world. There is no punishment in this world. There are only blessings and curses. So the first question we have to ask is, what are blessings and curses even for? We call God's name is called Tov, which means good, and we call God Hatov Vehametiv. God is good and does good. So how does all this fit in? Because you could say, well, it sounds to me like he's out to punish us and get us and strike us with lightning. And even people who are a little, you know, have their doubts about whether there's God out there will often use the phrase and say, oh, I'm probably going to get struck by lightning by saying this. It's like that vision is of a punitive God as opposed to a loving God. So God is good who does good. And so we have to understand the overall context of what blessings and curses are even for. So if God is only trying to do good for us, then the idea is that we are here, what's called good is Torah and mitzvot are called good. Living a life when we are walking in b'chukotai telechu. If you are walking in my decrees and observing my commandments, what's so good about that is that's going to give you the good life. That is the good life. And I want you to have the good life. So in order to have the good life and be able to be free to live a life, a spiritual life, a life of Torah, a life of mitzvot, says that we need to have two things. We need to have physical, kind of a baseline physical comfort, and we have to have peace of mind. Because a person can have physical comfort and be always worried and have a lot of anxiety, and they're miserable. They could be living in a mansion with many servants, and they could be miserable. So having peace of mind as well as physical, you know, the basic physical things that we need to stay comfortable because we live in a physical body, that allows us to then be able to carry on and devote ourselves to a life of Torah and mitzvahs. So that's what the blessings are for. They're not ends, they are means. So that if you have health, and you have a place to live, and you have food, and your enemies are not after you, and you are emotionally tranquil, and everything is okay, and you have that sense of peacefulness, like contentment, that will allow us then to live a life of Torah and mitzvot. And if we don't have those things, it just gets harder and harder and harder. A person who, like when we say the blessing of Asher Yatzar in the morning, or after we've used the bathroom, we say that if my body wasn't functioning, I couldn't stand before you for even a minute. I'm worried about, you know, where's the bathroom? You know, I need, you know, things are either stopped up or overflowing or whatever's going wrong. That becomes my primary concern. How am I supposed to think about God? I can't think about anything. I'm thinking about my most immediate needs. So it's a little bit like Maslow's hierarchy of needs. First things first, and then you can focus on the higher level. So it says Torah Mitzvot is higher level, and so we want to have a life where we have our bases covered so that we can proceed. Susan.
Piano
player.
If you do these things, if then.
If then. That would make sense if we were doing physical things that resulted in physical benefit. Mm-hmm. So then it would seem like if I am a good farmer, then I will have a good crop. But if I say, if I follow the mitzvot, the rain is going to come, we wouldn't not necessarily be able to connect those dots. So this is, first of all, it's a big blessing for us to even be told what the dots are to connect. Otherwise, we would never figure that out in a million years. Like, you're telling me I push this button and, you know, something happens over there? Where's the wire? I don't see the connection. So this is saying, here are the connections so that you know. So once I know, then I know. Then it's a blessing to know what the consequences are. The consequences for not performing are really only designed to get our attention. And so they're divided, if you can just see, looking on page 711, it's called the tochacha, which means the reproving, and it comes from the word to show somebody something. I'm going to show you, I'm going to hopefully give you a wake-up call, and we'll see that they're in a series. There's the first series. Now here it says punishments, but they're not really called punishments. They're curses. The first series, the second series, the third series, the fourth series, and the fifth series. And it's divided up in kind of going in stages. Like, my goal is to wake you up. My goal is not to pulverize you. My goal is to get your attention so that you will return. Since I didn't get your attention when things were good, so how else can I get your attention? If I gave you $1 million and you didn't do what I asked you to do, I'm not thinking that giving you $2 million is going to help. It may be that giving you, taking away your million and having you say, wait, what happened, that might be the answer. Roberta.
Some of the curses are so horrible.
They are.
I mean, they're so... you can't even imagine.
They're horrific. They are horrific curses.
So afraid of them.
Yeah, so you say, you know, God prefers that we are in this covenant and are doing things based on love. But think about a parent. If you had a choice, you would want your child to do what is right to do because it's the right thing to do and because you ask them to do it and they love you and want to do it. But if you had the choice between that and them, and then the second choice, let's say, was they didn't do it and they ruined their lives, you wouldn't want that. If they would, like, the next best is, okay, so they're going to do what you ask because they're afraid of you, that's not your ideal, but you'd rather them do it because they're afraid rather than not do it at all and really destroy themselves. So it definitely is the second option and is not what God is looking to do.
Lynn. So curses only happen to people who are not observing the mitzvah?
So first of all, these are all communal. This is for the Jewish people as a whole. It is not for an individual. Because unless you live in a cartoon, rain doesn't just fall on one field. You know, it's the rain, or it is global. So it is for the Jewish people. So our exile, the exile the Jewish people are in now, that's considered to be, you could look through these and come up with, like, a lot of these curses have happened, and the exile has happened. And that's one of the things is, I will exile you to the land of your enemies, and then you're going to see how that goes with you. You didn't enjoy being in my land and following the laws that I asked you to follow there. Well, how do you like being, then we'll kick you out, time out.
Because one person?
Not one person. The Jewish people as
a whole. I understand, but what's the collective?
What's the collective?
Yeah, I mean,
how many? Like, what's the tipping point? That's a good question. We don't know. It has to be enough to be to make it the, you know, as you could ask that. The preponderance. Yeah, I don't know if it's like a plurality or if it's a, you know, 51-49. maybe it's where it's enough to affect a change. There's no such time when everyone is perfect. So it can't be like, oh, well, if everyone's not perfect, you know, that's it. And it can't be that it's also a 51-49. I'm thinking that's not it. I'm thinking that it's like when you describe like that book Tipping Point, when does something become so much of something that it makes a difference? It could be that it's fewer. It could be that it's a 20%, 80%. It could be that it takes fewer number of people. It may depend who they are. If it's the leadership or if it's the people who are making the difference, it's like in any organization. Even though we have a democratic society, not all people are equal in an organization. And if some people, they could have a few people who are doing the wrong things, they can ruin it for everybody.
So that leads me to believe that it is incumbent upon us to be influential.
It is very incumbent upon us to be influential. That is why, and we have a fundamental concept, which is Kol Yisrael Arevim Ze Laze. All of Israel is responsible for one another. And it's not a matter of like, well, you know, that's your business and this is my business. I'm like, I'm sorry, we're all on the same ship, and we cannot say, and we don't associate, this is actually a Talmudic thing, where it says a person drilling a hole under their own seat on the ship. It's like, well, it's my seat, I can drill a hole if I want to. It's like, I'm on your ship. You can't. So it's not considered being a, you know, a busybody to be involved and care about what other Jewish people are doing. We have to care because we are all in this together, and we don't have the idea of, you know, Christianity has personal salvation. You know, we don't. There's no Jewish bumper sticker that says, "I've been saved." It's like Mazel Tov. You know, we don't have that. It's all of us or none of us.
We don't.
I'm sorry.
We also don't proselytize.
We don't proselytize to non-Jews,
oh,
but we do to Jews.
We are.
I mean, the thing is we are supposed to be teaching non-Jews the laws of B'nai Noach. They are obligated in that, and we are supposed to be teaching that. That is our responsibility to the whole world. To Jewish people, we are supposed to be teaching Torah, because we're all in this together. Peggy or Jan?
So, is this what we're to refer to when we look back at all the people who were killed in Saddam and the reason that Noah took on a few people on the ark and all the animals?
That was different.
Okay,
but I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you.
I just
continue your thought.
If this is retroactive to those.
Oh, retroactive time? First of all, those people weren't Jewish, and there was a different thing. They were under the laws of basic civilization, which they violated. So the people of Sodom, the things that they were doing, violated the what we now call the laws of Noah, basic civilization, which they were aware of, which is why you can only be punished and held accountable for something that you're aware of. You can't say that hold someone accountable who is not aware. But they were aware, and they knew that they were violating fundamental principles of humanity. So these laws are only for the Jewish people. This does not hold for the rest of humanity. The rest of humanity is not held to the same. They're not given the same thing. They're held to the laws of B'nai Noach. They're not held, because we'll see, one of the things at the end of the curses is about the Jewish people not following the laws of Shemitah, which we talked about last week, the sabbatical year in the land of Israel. Well, non-Jews are not held accountable for that in Denver, Colorado. That has nothing to do with them. So this is for the Jewish people, which is why it's called a miracle. It's only for us. The rest of the world works by nature. The Jewish people work above nature. We have a different system that we are participating in. The challenge is that when we go to live outside the land of Israel, we're in a dual place, because we are in a place that is operating with nature, Denver, Colorado, and we're Jewish people who operate above nature. So then what do you get then? You get a big mess. That's what you get. It's like, wait, what system am I in? What system am I a part of? Our mezuzahs on our doors remind us that this, it basically summarizes this. This is a summary of the blessings and the curses are in our mezuzah to remind us, like, this is how you're actually living, even though it doesn't appear to be that way. So that's our challenge. So it's a ve'im shamoa, and if you hearken to my commandments, then blah, 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 and if you don't, I will close up the heavens, and it gives the whole
part of the Shema.
Mm-hmm. Part of the Shema. Second paragraph of the Shema.
Not quoted from this
parsha. No, it's in other places as well. Yeah. So here's what's really interesting. If you look at column inches about the blessings and the curses, the blessings start at the beginning of our parsha, im b'chukotai, and if you look in, so that's verse 3, and they basically And on the top of page 711, the last phrase of it is verse 13, I am Hashem your God who took you out of the land of Egypt from being their slaves. I broke the staves of your yoke and I led you erect. Okay, that's the end of the blessings, and then starts the Tochacha. So
eight verses.
I'm sorry?
Eight verses.
Right, so it's pretty small. You could say, does that mean our blessings are really small? And then we look at the pages and pages of Tochacha. So what's interesting is the blessings are written in condensed form. And they are not elaborated on, because the blessings are all-encompassing. How do we know that they're all-encompassing? So here's a beautiful thing with the letters that are used to describe the blessings. If you go to back to page 708, the very first letter of this parsha that starts the word im is the letter
Aleph.
Now go to the end of verse 13, which in the Hebrew is... There's the word komamiyot. It's the one, and then there's a lot of white space in the line. There's only one word. It ends with a tav. So what do we have for the brachas? We have the brachas begin with an aleph, which is the first letter of the Hebrew alphabet, and it ends with the tav, which is the last letter of the Hebrew alphabet, which means anything that is aleph to tav always means complete, comprehensive, all-encompassing. Is like, I love you from A to Z, from Aleph to Tav. Anytime we invoke those letters, we're talking about something all-encompassing, regardless of how short the material is in between. So when we're talking about the brachas, even though they take up fewer lines, they're actually considered much more comprehensive. Then you could say, well, it looks like the curses have been pretty comprehensive. You know, if we look at Jewish history of what's happened, and say, okay, so imagine those are the curses, and imagine the brachas being even more so. And we have a similar idea, the reverse, about the letters that are used to describe the curses. So what did those start with? So in verse 14, Yud Dalid, it starts with, but if you will not listen to me. So the first letter is the word Vav, for the word Va'im, and if. And the curses end, go a couple of pages, it's looking like, oh my gosh, this is looking scary, 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 scary. So it ends with page 717. I know, it's like, don't even read these. Okay, verse 45 is the last word of the conclusion of the admonition. I remember them. For them, the covenant of the ancients, those whom I have taken out of the land of Egypt before the eyes of the nations, to be God unto them, I am Hashem. Mm-hmm. So Hashem is Yud, He, Vav, He. So the last letter of the admonition is the letter He. Yes. And the first letter of the was the word Vav. Okay, so where are Vav and He in the alphabet?
We go backwards.
It goes backwards, and they're right next to you, next to each other. It goes alphabet, gimel, dalet, Hey, Vav. It's like, it looked like it was a whole big thing. It's really just Hey and Vav. It's just from Hey to Vav. And it's reversed, and it's supposed to also convey the idea that anytime something is reversed means that there's something illusory about it. There's something that's a bit of an illusion. There's something temporary. There's something a little backwards about it. That the idea of the curses, that it's not that we won't feel them. We will feel them. But that they are not meant to be understood as a true picture of what the reality is that God is trying to create. It's like, I just need to do this in order to... It's almost like when a parent has to punish a child, how the child experiences the pain or the whatever of whatever it is, but they also hopefully know that the relationship is good enough and strong enough that they really do know that the parent loves them, and so they can accept it. So it says, this is the illusion, lest you think, the illusion is that this is not that the things aren't happening, but that they're coming from a place of hatred and cruelty. They're not coming from that place. They're coming from a place of tochacha. They're coming from a place of, I'm trying to get you back on track. Pam. Oh, okay. Valerie.
I'm feeling like maybe the shortness of the blessings is because it's really easy.
What's easy?
To be obedient.
Oh, it's really easy to be obedient?
Oh, no.
Actually, it's not so easy. It is, because human nature gets in the way. We don't want to, well, I don't want to take a survey here, but we could talk about how we're doing and everything.
Well, every morning I pray. I ask God to help me walk with Him and do do what I'm supposed to be doing.
Right, and there are 613 mitzvot that are to be fully complied with. And people have all sorts of reasons why they're not doing what they're supposed to do. And they could have good reasons. I have a really good reason why I'm not doing it. And I may have a bad reason. I could have lots of reasons. It's not so easy unless one completely is walking in it and is immersed in it and wants to connect. But even then, it is still challenging because we have our human nature. It has to be a choice. We have to have free choice, which means there has to be a yetzer hara. There has to be an inclination not to do it. It's human nature, usually, when we're commanded to do something, to not want to do it. So interestingly, that non-Jewish people don't, bless you, are not considered to have a yetzer hara in following the Torah because they're not commanded to do it. They're like, oh, that looks, I can do that. It's like, wait till you're commanded to do it and you're obligated. So that's why in the conversion, a person said, you know now, that before you converted, you could do A, B, C, or D. Once you convert, never again, you can't do it anymore. And there's just something that gets our feathers up about being commanded because we're human nature. We're dafka. We just like, that just gets our feathers up because we want to be in charge of ourselves. And if I'm in charge of myself, I get a call when I'm doing what I do. So that's our human nature. And but that means that our choice is a real choice then. So when we make a choice, it's really, we have ownership of it. So on one hand, you could say, yes, it's easy. So it's true. I would say maybe a more accurate word is that it's simple. It's simple, but it's not easy. It's simple. It's very straightforward. It's like, what's the problem? Here's what you do. But do you ever have that? You know, if somebody has, let's say somebody like bites their nails, and you say to them, so stop. You smoke, so stop. You know, you can pick it, and I can say that easily for someone else. So stop. Like, so, well, that's easy for you to say. So, but what about the person who is in it? So the person who is in a habit or in a way of walking of life, they're in it. So it also leads to a good idea of what you're connecting to. In b'chukotai telechu. It really, when it says, if you will follow my decrees and observe my commandments, it doesn't really mean to observe. It means to walk in. In my chukim, walk. That, for the word holech. You walk in them. That's your environment. That's the context of your life. So in that way, that can make it easier. If one makes that one's context of one's life, then one has a much better chance of being able to observe everything. If someone is trying to have different context of their life, then anything that the Torah is asking of us seems to be the antithesis of that. But I wanted to do this. It's like, well, the Torah is saying to be in this life. It's like, but I wanted also to be in this life. It's like, well, try straddling that and see how that works. I remember Rabbi Tversky used to always say, a person who sits on the fence has a sore tuchus. It's like, that's what you get. It's not so easy. It fills us with a lot of conflict and a lot of difficulties that we are trying to navigate. So the truth is, we are living in the United States of America. By definition, even the most, quote, person who's walking in there, quote, the most, what I won't call a holy, because it makes it sound otherworldly. Being holy is not being otherworldly. It means being in this world within a context of Torah and mitzvot. The most dedicated person doing that, if they're living in the United States of America, is challenged right and left. Even if they go into King Soopers. You know, you go into the store and you are confronted with magazines that have pictures, language, whatever, that is not what you want to see. You have checkers dressed in revealing things you don't want to see, saying things you don't want to hear. So what are you going to do, starve, have all your food shipped into your house? No, you're going to be in the world. So what do? So we have a friend who's a rabbi. He's very nearsighted. He takes off his glasses when he goes into line. So he doesn't see it because we're human beings. And if you see a headline, it's like, oh, you know, like rubbernecking everything. You know, it's like we have to see and be with everything. So it's not easy. It is not easy. And even you think, oh, well, I'll go to the land of Israel and that'll be easy. It's like, oh, no, no, no. That doesn't happen either. Because as the land of Israel is raw, all the veils are gone. And for better and for worse, you get the most expressed versions of everything. The greatest good, I read a statistic, how many nonprofits are in the land of, in the state of Israel? How many nonprofits do you think there are in the state of Israel?
Thousands.
45,000. 6,000 nonprofits. It's like, what, like each person is running their own nonprofit?
Yeah.
There's only 6 million people there. Okay, so that's an amazing thing. And what other things are going on there? We don't want to talk about it or hear about it or know about it. It's everything. It's the Jewish human condition is revealed in all of its everything, for better and for worse. So this Bechukotai, now remember, this was given to the Jewish people who were the ones who left Egypt, who witnessed the plagues, who saw the splitting of the sea, who witnessed the Ten Commandments, were given the Ten Commandments. Those people have to be warned? It's like, uh-huh. Human nature trumps everything. It doesn't matter. You can have had the most amazing spiritual experience. Everyone is challenged. So the challenge that is one of the most difficult, which is referred to, that we'll conclude with, because I think it fascinates me every year. If you want to take a look at page 713, verse 21. Let's see. Roberta, would you like to read verse 21 for us, please?
If you behave casually with me and refuse to heed me, then I shall lay a further blow upon you. 7 ways like your sins.
Okay, great. Ouch. Okay. So, but here's like, what's the sin? It's like, if you behave casually with me. And then we'll repeat that if you see in the fourth series, verse 23, it says, if despite these you will not be chastised toward me and you behave casually with me. And the fifth series, if despite this you will not heed me and you behave with me with casualness, I will behave with you with casualness. So it's like, what is casualness? So the Hebrew word is keri, and it's spelled kuf resh yud, keri. Casualness. It says, what is casualness? So it means a lot of things, and it's really worth a discussion all by itself. But just to give an idea, just to keep in mind, because I think this can be a description of how we do lots of things in our life, not just our, I'm not trying to compartmentalize, so that's part of being carry of casualness. Casualness is when you compartmentalize your life. I'm doing this at this time and this at another time. The very act of compartmentalizing one's life is called being casual with God, because it means like, oh, you know, when I'm in the synagogue or when it's a holiday or when it's whatever, I do this. And when I'm doing like my thing, then I do my thing. So that's called having a casual relationship. We would say, if we were married and we had a spouse who said, you know, like when I'm in town, I'll be home for dinner, whatever. But you know, if I'm out of town, I'm going to go out with some other girl I find, whatever. But, you know, you'd say, well, that's a pretty casual relationship. I would give it other names. But casualness is the idea of compartmentalizing, is the definition of one definition of casualness. It also has to do, so that applies to anything that we're trying to do in our life, anytime we're trying to create ourselves as an integrated person in anything. How I treat my friends, how I deal with business. I can't say, oh, you know, I want, when I go to the store, everybody should be honest with me, but in my business, I need to, you know, cut corners because that's the only way I can survive. That's called having a casual relationship with business ethics. So the idea of casualness and the danger of it applies to really every aspect of our life. The Torah is talking about it, and specifically our spiritual growth. It also refers to doing things in a being distracted, what I would call multitasking, where we're not giving anything our full attention. We're just multitasking, and we're multitasking every aspect of our life so that no one thing ever gets our full attention. So it talks about someone who's making a blessing. So in the Jewish context, the Torah context, making a blessing while you're walking around or while you're kind of making faces to someone else, like you're saying hamotzi, and you go, Baruch Atah. And it's like, what are you concentrating on? You're not communicating, and you're not making a blessing either. So what is that? It says, just focus. And that, talk about something that's hard for us to do, focusing. You know, my headset for my phone broke. I'm like beside myself. I can't be on the phone and do something else at the same time. I don't even know what to do with myself. Okay. There's another thing that's called carry, is by doing something, casualness is by rote. Just being habitual about something. So the challenge is having a habit for something is a good thing when we're talking about the mechanics of doing something. We want to drive, you know, we want to master the steering, looking in the mirror and signals and everything else. That we need that to be a habit. If that's not a habit, that's called a new driver. Okay, so we want that to be a habit. And then once we have that habit down in the mechanics of something, should hopefully give us the opportunity to focus on the content of what we're doing. Now I can focus on being a courteous driver, an attentive driver, you know, other things that have to do with what I'm trying to do. So the same thing is true with things that we are doing spiritually. Once we have mastered the mechanics of something, that's a great place for habit. But then if we just be our, by rote, just saying words without thinking, praying without thinking. Again, it's like, again, in an intimate relationship, if your spouse or friend just says, oh, I love you, and like, oh, you know, did you see, and then they start talking about something, it's like, you know, you said the words, but I'm just not feeling any emotion there. So, like, where's the kavana? So that is also called carry. When we do things that are just like, when I'm in the mood for it, I'll do it, and if I'm not in the mood, I won't do it, it's like, well, then what religion is that? That's called the religion of self. I do what I want to do when I feel like doing it, which is like when I go cross-country skiing. So, like, you know, when the sky is blue and it's blue wax and whatever, then I go. But I wouldn't say that I'm devoted to skiing. I couldn't say that. So that's called a casualness also. That's like, just depends on my mood and my whim. And when I'm really in the mood, boy, you'll never find someone better than me. And if I'm not in the mood, then I'm out. So again, no relationship can withstand that. So all of these things have to do with this casualness. It's just what we would apply to any relationship we had. That if it was just kind of a fair weather friend? No, most people are not really looking for so many fair weather friends in their life because it doesn't really add. In fact, it detracts. I'd rather not have you than have it be fair weather, because what does that do? I can't count on that. So that's the idea of casualness also. The word carry is also related to cold from the word car, and has to do with being cold. Car means the kuf resh car means cold, which means to be unresponsive to what we're doing. We do something, and we do something that's meaningful, but it doesn't impact us. It's like we're Teflon coated, and we're just frozen to what the impact is. So this can happen in all sorts of things in our life as well. We can have a conversation with a person, they're telling us something very important, and we remain unaffected by it. We go someplace, and we see amazing sights, whether inspiring or discouraging, and we're unaffected. It's like, that's called being car. That's called being cold. It says God can give us blessings, and we're unaffected by that. It's like, oh, yeah, whatever. I have my health. It says even the word whatever, that phrase, should be stricken from the language of somebody who is trying to have a not casual life. Whatever. Whatever implies I don't care. Okay, I don't care, whatever. It says, whatever, when it comes to spiritual growth, will never get us anywhere. It says, all of this in those three little words, if you're going to act with me, carry, then I'm going to have to up the ante because you're not paying attention. So our goal is to pay attention, to not do things carry, and not act in that way, so that we can have all of the brachas from Aleph to Taf in our life, in the life of all Jewish people. When these curses are read, they are always read quickly and quietly. So the Baal Kori, it's not that they lost the person who's reading the Torah, it's not that they lost their voice. They're trying to get through them quickly. You could say, well, if they're so bad, let's just not read them. But we do have to read them because it's a blessing for us to know what the consequences are. These consequences are only designed to help us. Hopefully, we will only go from strength to strength, because we will end this parsha of Bechukotai with Chazak, Chazak, Venit Chazek. Strength, strength, and may we be strengthened. And may we have many chances to start over. That the Pesach Sheni, that we should have lots of opportunities. Always give ourselves a fresh slate, a fresh chance, and take the opportunity of Lag BaOmer and throw into the fire all the things that are what looks like trash. Watch the energy be released from it. Have a plan. Take it as an opportunity for teshuva to refocus, restart, and follow in the lead of Rabbi Akiva, who was prepared to start over and never despaired of himself or what he was meant to do in this world, and just began again. So God willing, we'll all have lots and lots of second chances. Amen. Have a wonderful Shabbos.
And carry also is from Mikre.
Yes, from Mikre of happenstance.
You have to do it by chance.
By chance. Exactly. And that's another whole big thing about when we treat that what God does to us is like, oh, this just happened by chance. It wasn't anything intentional. So that's called cruelty, if we think that God is acting in that way.